The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show here on this lovely September 5th, 2015. I'm here in studio with Jim Saulnier, Certified Financial Planner, Peter Scott, Esquire is the official title. Also with me, did I introduce myself? I forget.
No, you didn't.
No, I'm Chris Stein, a Certified Financial Planner and a finance instructor at Colorado State University. Jim is handing me his iPad, which he's somehow forgotten how to use after owning one for several years.
It's asking for the out of the blue. Why is it asking for a password?
I don't know. Maybe because you deleted it.
No, I didn't do anything.
No, I'm pretty sure you did.
Do you remember what it is?
I will find out momentarily. Must have. Yep.
Thank you.
So now Jim can look up the things he needs to say on the radio.
Exactly.
Apparently,
the password was my.
And the password is.
For those hackers out there listening,
they wanted that's pretty good. That sounded just like the old password. Mm-hmm. It was asking me all of a sudden for a password to my Wi-Fi, which it shouldn't. It never has in the past.
Well, occasionally it wants you to remind it.
I'm glad you remembered what it is because I had no clue.
Hmm. Well, okay. I'm glad I was here then. Yeah. So this is a live recorded show. So no phone calls today. This is Labor Day weekend in 2015. If you're listening to this live or if you're listening post-show via iTunes or from the retirementandiraShow.com website, this is playing on Labor Day weekend. Are we going to cover Labor Day topics, Jim?
Oh, that would have been better than what we have.
Probably a good idea. Although last year when we covered Labor Day topics, it turns out to be
a
propensity of communist thought.
Yes.
Involved in the beginnings of
what
Labor
we did
Day.
Last Labor Day is we were live the week before, Pete, and we did a Labor Day trivia. We used to do these trivia shows. We should do it with Pete. It would be fun trying to get him to do it. So we would do a trivia show.
It won't be fun because he'll know all the answers.
For a holiday.
It could be laborious, too.
So we would do a trivia show tied to a certain holiday. Mm-hmm. We did one for Christmas, Easter, and then we would tie the answer somehow to retirement planning.
I have every confidence that you were able to do that.
Oh, we did. It was a little convoluted, but it worked. Mm-hmm. When we did the Labor Day one, Amanda in the office, who's no longer with us, she'd be the one who'd pull the questions together. Chris and I would never see him until literally the day before she'd give them to us. So it was kind of, we were flying by the seat of our pants, and we noticed a very communistic holiday. A lot of the questions had to do with Karl Marx and
For the labor movement,
the Bolsheviks.
The labor party.
Mm-hmm. Hervé Velazquez.
Okay. I have no idea who he is. Is he like Chow or whatever his name is?
No, he's the guy in Fantasy Island.
Che, not Chow, right? Che. Who's that guy in the, it's just one name on a t-shirt.
You're talking about Che Guevara?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that he was part of it. Hervé Velazquez was not part of it. He was on Fantasy Island with Ricardo Montalban.
Was he tattoo?
Yes, he was.
Oh, you're playing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I was just seeing if you were paying attention.
I have no idea. I mean, I'm paying attention, but I have no idea what you're talking about. Okay. But no, it would have been nice to hit Pete and I with this idea of doing labor-related show. We could have did a whole show on ERISA.
You didn't realize that this weekend was Labor Day?
No.
Oh,
did you, Pete?
Oh, yeah. I knew it was.
Well, the two of you could have shared it with your oh-so-humble host.
It's okay. We have fabulous topics.
We do have fabulous topics, but none of them tie to Labor Day. We could have talked about the Department of Labor, how they regulate retirement plans.
I think this all has to do with labor. We have IRA topics that you are only able to contribute to an IRA if you have involved yourself labored. With labor.
We're going
to
talk about pets, timeshares, and airline miles. What does that have to do with Labor Day?
You travel. You know, Labor Day is a big travel weekend, so there's where the airline miles come in. You have to board your pets while you're traveling, so there's where your pets come in. What was the third one?
Timeshares.
You're going to stay at a timeshare on vacation on your Labor Day weekend. It all ties together.
And you have to labor long and hard to pay the timeshare fees.
That's what we'll get into.
So there's all kinds of connection to Labor Day.
So your job, Chris,
yes,
will be to tie today's show's topics.
I just did.
To labor.
I just did.
All right.
Okay.
But anyways, we want to give everyone a good shout out in Northern Colorado. Hope you are enjoying the Labor Day. It's supposed to be a nice weekend.
I think it's
supposed to cool down from the hot. Yesterday had to have been the hottest day of the year. It was.
Really?
It was hot.
Where?
Here. Was it yesterday? Not yesterday.
I don't think so.
Another day was hot.
Yes. Yeah, there was another day.
There was another day that was very hot, yes, this summer. There was the hottest day of the year this summer.
Yeah, but it was like a few days ago. It was hot. I remember saying to somebody I was with, today has got to be the hottest day of the year. And they agreed with me.
I think it's because you spent most of the days of the summer indoors and you just hadn't noticed how hot it was.
Who was I talking to?
I can't answer that.
I can't remember because today's only Tuesday. Yesterday was Monday. Yesterday wasn't overly hot.
No, it was kind of cool yesterday, relatively.
Maybe it was Friday. What did I do
Sunday
on
was
Friday?
Pretty hot. No idea. I don't think we should spend the show figuring it out,
though. But one of the more recent days was the hottest day of the year. This weekend's supposed to be nice and then cool down into the 70s.
Fall.
Like Sunday or Monday-ish.
Yeah.
So
we're in September.
It felt fallish last week a little bit.
It did.
We had those few days.
Yeah, a few days. I got spoiled.
Kind of smelled and felt like fall.
The Starbucks pumpkin spice lattes will be coming out shortly. That's my sure sign of fall.
I think aren't they putting actual pumpkin in it this
time? They are.
They
have greatly improved the...
How do you know? I mean, you enjoyed them before. Now if they do the real thing, you may not like it as much.
I'm just saying, according to the article I read, they have greatly improved that Starbucks and Panera Bread are kind of in this...
Pumpkin race?
Pumpkin spice war. And who can make the most natural pumpkin spice latte this year? So,
interesting. Well, there's plenty of pumpkins this time of year, so it seems appropriate.
Yeah. But anyways, I like Starbucks pumpkin spice lattes. They'll be out shortly. That's my first sign of fall. When we start getting the pumpkin spice latte at Starbucks, it's fall.
Thanks for sharing.
Are you going to be in line, kind of like Black Friday? Are you going to show up at night?
I don't do lines anymore. I order right from my smartphone. I walk in. Coffee's right there. Pick it up.
You pre-order?
Yeah. Starbucks app now pre-orders.
What?
It pre-orders. You don't have to wait in line anymore. You know how the line is long and
sometimes,
you always get that yuppie idiot in front of you ordering a coffee whose name is like 18 sentences long?
Yeah.
You don't have to deal with those people anymore.
Really?
You just walk to the front of the line.
Prepaid and you just...
Prepaid, sitting right there on the counter.
Mm. So you don't have to deal with
how
the...
How far ahead do you have to...
The app will determine the closest Starbucks to you. And it recommends it. And it'll say, if you want this Starbucks, it'll be ready in 2 minutes. If you want this one, it might be ready in 4 minutes or something.
Really?
Yes. So
it's pretty fancy for coffee.
It is. And then you walk in, and next to the checkout counter will be all the coffees that are to go. And you look for the one with your name on it. And the thing is, they don't ask for an ID. They don't even ask your name.
If I want free coffee, I'm just going to wander in there and pick one up.
And you just, because at one point I was walking in to get mine, and the woman was there. She says, oh, are you Jim? I said, yes, I am. Here's your coffee. What if my name was Bill and I just wanted a free coffee? Yeah, I'm Jim.
Pretty good.
So,
Well, I guess they give you all sorts of convenience and apps and things when you spend $15 a cup on coffee.
Nah, it's about $4 or $5.
Yeah. It's just a matter of
speaking
degree.
Of which, here comes my coffee now.
Now you're having delivered coffee to
like
the
that,
radio
huh?
show? Oh, my goodness.
Thank you.
You have to be kidding me.
No.
Jim, this is really happening right now. He ordered coffee to be delivered while we were recording the radio show.
I like that.
Oh, my goodness.
Notice his timing on all of this.
Yeah,
it was just impeccable.
They were waiting outside the door until they heard us talking about it.
So I ordered this from my app and got it delivered.
Did you make Justin pay for it as well?
No, you pay right from your app with it.
But you made him go get it.
He was already out getting lunch. So I said, do you mind going by Starbucks? And he said, just place the order.
And he had to say, I'm Jim?
Apparently, or he went in there and just read it because my grande iced skinny hazelnut latte.
That's approaching 18 sentences, just so you know. Pot.
Okay, so. Today's show, we have a cornucopia of topics. A little fall theme here.
It's a little early for that. Plus the fall theme. Plus the emphasis theme on you is a little disconcerting. Sorry.
You who?
Cornucopia?
Cornucopia. Oh, don't tell me I screwed that word up too.
Maybe that's an acceptable
way of
saying it.
Pete, how do you say cornucopia?
I think that's the Boston way to say it.
We're not corning someone. You just say, corn you, buddy. Corn you, copia.
How do you say cornucopia?
Cornucopia. Not you. That's how I've always said it. Maybe it's wrong.
How do you say it?
Maybe it's you.
Cornucopia.
Cornucopia?
Not cornucopia.
Cornucopia? Don't go to dictionary.com because you're probably right, and then you're going to play that stupid voice with the French accent and make me look like a fool.
It's either way, the pronunciation really isn't the issue. It was the earliness of saying such a thing. It's just the 1st of September.
It's Labor Day weekend. Summer's over. My sweet summer is gone. You like that song, huh?
Harvest time is not here yet.
I was going to have you play that song today. Maybe I still will.
Well, that's another thing you need to warn me about ahead of time.
Right.
But I could probably find it.
Because today's show, My Sweet Summer Is Gone, would have been a good appropriate song.
Probably.
I thought so.
After the break, we'll hear Jim sing.
Yes.
Oh, no, you don't want to hear me sing My Sweet Summer Is Gone. Okay, so that said, we have a little bit on splitting IRAs and divorce, since we had two divorce-related questions recently, Pete.
We did.
Chris, I know you wanted to bring to our listeners' attention, and readers on the blog, to their attention, issues with sending kids to college since CSU is starting.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you and Pete had chatted about that, so Pete's going to take over on that. And then, Pete, I was reading Money Magazine, and there's a really cool article in there, not a very long one, on difficult assets to pass along, assets that Chris and I have chatted about before, and I let you look at the article, and you added another asset to it.
I did.
And we thought that would be a good little topic today as well. So that's what we'll be chatting about. We'll also be doing the top three songs in America 35 years ago, 40 years ago, and 80 years ago. So quite a plethora.
Not necessarily in that order, but we'll get to them.
Well, the other way. I said it backwards. I went 40, 35, 80.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But we're going 80, 35, 40.
Very good.
80, 40, 35.
80, 40, 35. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
We were testing you.
There are way too many numbers in this show, apparently.
Do you at least have the songs?
I have
them
ready to go.
Cool.
And I have hints.
And you have what's new on helpmysocialsecurity.com?
I will by the time we need it.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. So that's what's on today's show. We also want people to kick back, enjoy the weather. You're probably not going to sit inside for the full 2 hours, but you can listen to us off of iTunes. We also want to give a little shout-out to our iTunes listeners, a feisty little bunch we call them, Pete, but we're glad they do enjoy our show and putting it on. We still haven't put last week's show on, so I know some iTunes listeners get a little antsy when they don't get on there quick, and they end up sending us emails. Where's the show? Haven't updated it. We had a little issue. Was it last week or the week before?
The week before.
I think it was the week before.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. We're really
during
a
live show.
We're still going to get these nasty grams now because it's been 2 weeks. But we had a little issue with something that was said on the show, and we don't want to send it to compliance for approval because they're going to shoot it down. So
something said by a listener.
Something said by a caller.
Or a caller, yes, a caller.
So we're going to bleep that part out, so by time compliance gets it, she won't have a conniption fit. And she'll send it through compliance. Because for you iTunes listeners, I keep trying to get you to understand, we do not produce the show solely for your entertainment. We do it as a Northern Colorado show, so we try to be a little bit fun and talk a little bit about Northern Colorado. But because we are practicing financial planners, and we also have a practicing attorney here who has his own set of rules he has to follow, we have to make sure that our shows go through an appropriate approval process for the SEC and FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority and Securities Exchange Commission. So we have a service that listens to them. There's a woman, I think her name is Shauna, wonderful woman. Hi, Shauna.
Oh, wonderful.
Everybody
very
hi.
Intelligent, very caring.
She is. Very wonderful. Very, best person out there. Mm-hmm. And she listens to our shows for 2 hours. She is paid to listen to our shows.
Wow. She's got one up on us.
So
true.
She sits there and listens to our shows just waiting mm-hmm. for us to say something we're not supposed to. Mm. This time she's just...
I wonder if she has a big red button. Like she hears it and it like marks it. Reject.
But most of the time we're not rejected. But the live show from 2 weeks ago, something was said by one of the callers that she would have read rejected.
Well, now Shauna is going to...
She's going to wonder what it was.
Well, depends on if we send her this show first or that other show. But she'll be like, wait a minute. What are they trying to hide from me?
She'll never know because it's going to be bleeped out.
Well, now she's going to know because we're talking about it.
Right, but she's not going to know what we bleeped out. She's just going to hear a big beep.
No, it's just going to disappear.
Oh, you're not beeping
the magic.
It?
That would sound weird because it's kind of about 5 seconds long.
Okay.
That's a long beep in radio time.
Okay. Well, anyways, that's why, iTunes listeners, it's not on iTunes just yet.
By the time you hear this, though, it should be.
You think so?
Well, yeah. We've got to remember we're in the time warp.
Okay. So maybe it's on. Maybe it isn't. But we do appreciate our iTunes listeners. And as a shout-out to everyone throughout the United
States
who listens
to us. We're doing a lot of shout-outs this show.
We are.
It's like the third one.
This is a holiday show, so I can make my own rules. We want to give a shout-out to everyone and let them know off of iTunes. We are available for coffee and a second opinion.
Mm.
Now, we can't...
Pumpkin spice latte coffee.
We could. We actually have little pods of pumpkin spice coffee now for a Keurig. So what we tell people throughout the United States is we don't necessarily... You can fly out here if you'd like to visit Colorado. Mm-hmm.
Fall's beautiful.
If
it's a nice
is
time
beautiful,
to visit.
You can come out here, do some skiing, smoke dope now, unfortunately.
Some water skiing, maybe?
Well, the mountains will have snow soon.
Not now. Not if you're expecting snow to ski on in Labor
All
Day.
Right, well, they can't ski
not gonna work.
Yet.
No. You water ski, you can.
You can go up there and look at where you could ski.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful because you can see the trees now.
You can. It's all green.
And the dirt.
But and then you can stop in the office. But if you don't want to do that, we will consult with you over the phone. And we'll even mail you your own little Keurig pod. And you can throw it in your Keurig machine and have the coffee on us. But second opinion.
Seems like a waste of... Postage?
No transportation. No one has taken us up on that. Mail me my pod.
Hmm. I'm sure they will.
We'd
now.
Be willing. Someone will
We'd
now.
Be willing, right? Pack it in a special little single Keurig pod box.
Do we have a special single
I don't know.
Keurig
we'll have to come up with
box.
One. Can't just stuff it in an envelope.
We have those bubble envelopes. We'll put it in that.
Yeah, good luck.
You don't think it'll make it?
I think it'll get smashed.
Well, I'll have the girls look for a
Then they'll be
special...
pouring the grounds in their drip... Coffee maker.
Single pod Keurig box.
Yeah.
We'll call you line and ask them. Do you have a little gift box that holds a single Keurig pod? But anyways, just wanted to let everybody from iTunes know that we do appreciate you listening very much. Thank you. Chris, why don't you mention to everyone what you wanted Pete to talk about with kids going back to college?
Oh, yeah. It is that time of year again. I know the date differs around the country at different universities here in Northern Colorado. We pretty much have all gone back to school. I started last week. Actually, this is week two, so a week ago, a couple weeks ago when the show is airing. So something that came to our attention just in the past couple of years is that with the new HIPAA regulations, relatively new, they're not new this year, but they it's been impacting a lot of people, and I'm sure when you go to the doctor, you now have gotten really used to filing or signing the HIPAA waiver or the HIPAA permission form that controls what information about you can be shared with whom and with maybe other physicians and nurses and insurance companies and that sort of thing. But a typically unaddressed situation is when you have a child who has reached legal age, adult age, goes off to school and has some kind of medical issue, maybe an accident, and they find themselves in the hospital. Under the way that HIPAA can be applied, you, the parent, aren't automatically granted information or access to that child. And that should sound very disconcerting to people, that they have this child, they're not even notified that they've been in, say, a car accident or what have you. Maybe you have been by the police, but if they're in a rock climbing accident or something and end up in the hospital, without the proper permissions, the hospital cannot discuss it with you unless they kind of, there is kind of an override if you read it very carefully, but the safest bet is to actually prepare some estate planning documents, what is typically considered an estate planning document, and that's where Pete's going to come in and describe what simple document needs to be in place so that if your child finds themselves in that position, the medical system will be free to talk to you, the parent, about it.
Right, and I think, Pete, what I want our listeners to know, most parents go to great length to send their kids off to school. They're going to help them. They might buy new clothes. They might help them with their books, a new computer. They probably drive them there, help them move into the dorm room. They do all of that. They go to great lengths. They give them a little bit of an allowance to make sure they have a little bit of money. And they put everything together. And they forget, in my opinion, some of the most important things to do, which is to put the, they're little adults now. They may be 18 and clueless, but they are adults in the eyes of the law, and you're not going to be able to help them as you could when they were younger and a minor. So what do parents need to look out for, Pete, with these young adult children going off to school?
Well, I think the same thing that Chris was talking about. And, you know, often when a child goes off to school, they're still on the parents' health plan. So they're still paying, but I think comes as a real shock to parents because they're so used to being involved in all sorts of decisions for their younger children. And 18 doesn't seem to automatically cause them to be adult. If you just look at their behavior, you know that. And so the parents just assume that that will continue, but it doesn't. While they're responsible for paying the premiums and costs of the health insurance, they, as Chris said, they are not entitled to any information whatsoever on the health issues that child may be facing without the certain documents. And so what's recommended is a HIPAA release. We often do those where it's just a standalone HIPAA release before the child heads off to school.
And can I interject?
Sure.
Because people may not know this. HIPAA is H-I-P-P-A.
No.
Oh.
Close.
Yeah, but real close.
It was close.
Wait, I miss it.
It's H-I-P-A-A, is it not?
Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, H-I-P-A-A.
H-I-P-A-A.
Two A's, not two P's.
Thought it was two P's.
No, nope. Two A's.
Okay, well, I was one P too many. We had this whole P discussion last week, too.
Two P's in a pod?
The pod P's I was growing. We were talking about P's and pods. And
there's only one P here.
Right.
That would be a very deficient pod.
So for those who don't know, it's H-I-P-A-A.
Yes.
Correct. And so what that has done is criminalize the unauthorized disclosure of medical information. And so a lot of the medical personnel, they're quite concerned about having a criminal prosecution, which to my knowledge really hasn't happened yet, but who wants to be the first? And so as a result, when the parents call in to find out how their child is doing at the hospital, or even the school clinic for that matter, say, we can't tell you.
And they can't even admit the child is there.
That's right. That's right. So having that form completed, and if the child's, for example, if it hasn't been done, if the child's conscious and awake, they can always give the authorization. But if the child is unconscious, which is probably a parent's worst nightmare, they're just stuck. They can't get any information, and they can't even confirm the child's in the clinic or the hospital, wherever it is. So having that form completed. The other is the medical power of attorney. Is can the parents make medical decisions for the child if they're unconscious, can't make them for themselves? And the answer is, if they're over 18, no, they cannot. They don't have the authority. And the only recourse is a guardianship through the courts, which is a long and drawn-out and expensive process. So by having a medical power of attorney and a HIPAA release will allow the parents to get the information on the HIPAA release. And then under the medical power of attorney, if necessary, they can make the medical decisions, authorize the care, the treatment, whatever it may be.
Now, do the children have to sign any of these documents, or can parents, if they already sent their little tykes out, is it too late, or can the parents get all this on their own?
The young adults to sign it themselves. Now, the fact that they're away at school doesn't prevent them from signing them. It's just the parents have to follow through and get that done.
So. Okay. So the parents would produce the documents and maybe send them to the kids like a PDF, and kids print it, sign it back.
Send it back.
Yeah. Usually they're notarized. A lot of them are. So
The HIPAA, I don't believe, has to be notarized. I don't think it's a bad idea, as you can probably talk about. The medical power of attorney, though, would Yes. Have to be notarized.
Yeah. Well, I think that was good information. We wanted to let you know because CSU is right here. Chris is a finance instructor at CSU, and a lot of parents are sending their 18-year-olds, and as you said, Chris, Pete, or both, even though they're 18 and adults, they still act like kids, but the rules are different now, and that's what we wanted to share with you.
Yep. Right. So when we come back from this short break, we're going to listen to the one of the top songs 80 years ago to kind of celebrate the 80-year anniversary of Social Security. The hint is the clever rhyming lyrics of this hit song composed by Cole Porter offered a snapshot into what was popular in the mid-1930s. So this is one of the top songs from 1935.
Wow.
Okay. Excellent.
Sounds good.
You guys can guess what it is when we come back.
I have no clue.
I figured. But this is the Retirement and IRA Show. Please stick with us. We'll be back with you shortly.
I'm so pathetic that I always abound it best. Instead of getting them off of my chest, to let them rest unexpressed. I hate parading my serenading as I probably miss a ball. But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are. You're the top, you're the Colosseum.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is one of the very top songs from 1935, which was the birth year of Social Security. That's why we're celebrating it as our lead up to what's new with helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
That sounds like the original. You could hear the crackling of the...
That is the original, yes. It was that song was written for the Anything Goes, a musical called Anything Goes.
Okay, that's where I've
heard it. By Cole Porter. And Anything Goes has been around for a while, redone. Music's been redone. I thought, since that had nice, clear lyrics, you could hear it. You could hear the clever rhyming lyrics that they were referring to in the hint. Jim, you want to take a guess as to what the name of the song is?
No.
Okay. Pete?
You're the Tops.
It is. You're the Top.
Well, you are acing. You can't get 70s music, but you are acing music from 80 30s, years ago.
I remember when this first came out. I remember actually hearing him sing that live.
So here's there's a little trivia point here. Famous American composer Cole Porter derived his name from the surnames of his parents, Kate Cole and Sam Porter. So he took the Cole and the Porter. That's it didn't put on here what his real name was.
Porter Cole.
Wow. Probably not.
I think it was, maybe it was Porter Porter.
Yeah, I don't know. Bob. It was probably just Bob. Yeah. Bob Porter.
Just amazed, Pete, that you are just acing these 80-year-old songs.
Well, it said it in
songs.
The song.
It did?
Yes.
Oh. Apparently, okay. I didn't hear it. Don't replay it. It's okay.
I'm not. Yeah. I'm not. You'll get the next one, Jim.
Oh,
it's one of your favorite songs ever from 1975.
Kung Fu Fighting?
We've already done that one. Not this time. A little later in the year. September 5th of 1975, towards the end of what would be that your senior year of college.
No, I wasn't in college in 75. I was 13 years old.
Oh.
I was 12, actually.
Okay. You weren't in college?
Well, when you were getting ready to go back to school.
I was smart enough to be in college.
Oh, I get it.
And still modest, even in those early days. Yeah.
So, do we have anything to finish up with from last time? I don't think so. We talked about, so I guess the point is, and it doesn't have to be college students.
Well, no.
It could be any young adults that have kind of moved out on their own, or even if they live at home. Just because they live at home does not mean that you, the parent, automatically have access. So maybe they're living at home until they're 19, 20, and you're paying all their bills, you pay for their housing, you feed them, you clothe them. They're just like they were when they were 14 to you, just maybe a little bit bigger and they eat more. But if something were to happen, the medical community is not allowed to divulge information to you by default. Right. There can be, you know, honestly, there are some doctors and nurses that in a real dire circumstance might choose to share it with you, but they don't have to, and they put themselves in a bit of jeopardy, and that's what they're worried about. The possibility that the child, who's now an adult, comes to and says, I hate my parents. I don't want anything to do with them. You had no right to share this information with them, and they get sued, and that's the fear.
Sure does.
So if they were to divulge information without the HIPAA waiver, they put themselves at risk of such a situation, so most of them aren't willing to do so.
Right.
So that's why it's important.
And I would suggest that these documents ought to be in place for any single children, maybe perhaps regardless of age, because one of the issues, and this is something we talk about in my office frequently, for a single person, the real issue is not so much the will, where things go at their death, but really what happens if they become injured to someone to handle their financial affairs, someone to handle their medical decisions, who can get the information. For those of us who are married, that's what our spouses are there for. They may not know what to do, but that's why they're there. But for single people, it's not as obvious as to who has that authority or should have that authority. So it becomes very important, Jim.
So Jim needs a document.
That's the only reason you have Mrs. Pete at home?
Giving someone the power to pull the plug. Right?
You ain't getting that power.
I was going to say, I'd be willing to volunteer for...
Yeah.
You know, we could sell tickets for that.
Next thing I know, I'm going to be being dragged away screaming, I'm not dead yet! I'm not dead yet!
So, and the other part of this, too, is the financial power of attorney for the college-age children, because they may be using the parents' credit card. They may have their own credit card or debit card or something like that. So for the parent to be able to monitor, perhaps, or even help with the financial aspects of it, not quite as important as the medical, but still, I think, something worth considering.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. Well, next topic we wanted to do kind of ties into this a little.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next topic, Pete?
I thought you were laying out the show today, Jim.
Yes, I thought.
Well,
this...
he's got all the papers there, so I can't see. Which one did you want to do next? Are you going to do the hard to pass on assets?
Well, that's what's up next, unless you wanted to. Well, actually, I think we've pretty well covered the Money Magazine. The other one came from...
Estate planning.
Yeah, the Trusted Estates
Trusted
magazine.
Estate. Right. But, the next one came from Money Magazine. I was reading an article in Money Magazine recently, and I tore that out. Money Magazine occasionally has interesting articles. For the most part, again, it's not a magazine I read regularly, but because I'm a CFP, it does come to me complimentarily every month. Mm-hmm. So I do peruse it. And that one caught my eye. Difficult to pass on assets.
Actually, they call it trickiest.
Trickiest to pass on assets. Mm. And the reason it caught my eye is one of them was pets, and I have a pet.
Mm.
So I thought Pete should talk about that.
Yes, I should.
So what we're going to talk about now is this Money Magazine article. So for those of you who may read Money Magazine, this is kind of a repeat for you, although Pete threw in a fourth. Money Magazine only listed three difficult to pass on or trickiest to pass on assets. Pete added a fourth, one that you and I have chatted about previously, timeshares. So, Pete, why don't you begin and list the four assets and then some of the ways or some of the important things people need to think of when passing on these assets?
Well, you've already mentioned pets at the intro. You said vacation homes, and that is true. Vacation homes in this area, we talk a lot about mountain cabins that have been in the family maybe for a few generations or the family built themselves. Those are a big issue. Airline miles. And then the ever-popular timeshares that we were talking earlier, more like a tar baby than they are anything else, just trying to get rid of them. But nonetheless, that's where we are. The pets has really been a very popular, of late, topic within the estate planning arena. It's kind of faded because it had its heyday with regard to making everyone aware of it. In fact, a good friend of mine who practices law in Florida, who is... doesn't have children, and she wrote this book called All My Children Wear Fur Coats. And it's about how to care for your pets during periods of disability and after you've passed on. And one of the things that this article doesn't mention that I think is very important is if there's a mental incapacity.
In the pet?
No, in the pet guardian, as they say in Boulder, because you don't own pets in Boulder, as you know. They have their ordinances that provide you're merely the guardian for the pet. Mm. But for those of you who own pets residing in counties outside of Boulder.
So if you're being sued because your pet bit someone, can you argue, I don't own it, I'm just the guardian?
I suppose you could,
maybe so.
But remember, a dog is entitled to their first bite.
Really?
Yes.
They get one bite free?
Uh-huh. That's right.
I did not know that. Is that Colorado law?
That is national, actually. It's common law. It's not statutory, but nonetheless.
So the first bite's free?
Yeah, because the dog doesn't, prior to that first bite, hasn't shown a propensity to be dangerous. And so a dog is presumed to not be dangerous until their first bite. Not strictly applied. It doesn't mean that the guardians are not liable. Although some of my clients who have pets, they are the parents of the pets, and their children were fur coats. But nonetheless, it doesn't mean that they're not responsible for the financial.
So how do you pass a pet on? Do you see a lot of trusts being made? So money is held in reserve or held in protection or custody for said pet? Is there a trustee of the trust that will take the money and take care of the pet with food and health care and things of that nature? Or do you just write in your will, if I die, I want my dog to go to so-and-so? And I heard of a case once, you can expand on this, Pete, where someone wanted their dog to die when they die and be buried with them, and the courts were ruling that that's okay because the pet was property, and there was a whole tizzy, which I was against that too. You don't kill a dog just to bury it with you. So why don't you expand on some of those?
Okay. Well, if you want to pick up that last one, you're right. With the exception of Boulder County, pets are considered property. And just like any livestock, although they're not categorized as livestock as we would think of it, but yes, they are. And people own them and are responsible, but also control their future. And very often when someone dies, if there's no provision for the pet, they will be off to the pound or some other rescue organization. They may or may not survive that experience and be placed in another home. So I think it's really important as pets that we own become part of the family and are important to us that we make provision for them. And so you have the same issues that you have during normal planning is that who's going to take care of that pet if you become mentally incapacitated, you can no longer care for the pet, or even physically incapacitated and can't care for the pet, although in that case, you can, at least as if you're mentally competent, can take care of that yourself. But we're including more and more provisions for pets and powers of attorney. And I'm talking financial powers of attorney. And then at death, I've done any number of pet trusts, and especially if people own birds, the parrots and cockatoos, and they have a life expectancy of 70, 80 years. So very often they will outlive their owner, and making provision for them is a very responsible thing to do. And it runs the gamut from saying just casually, if something happens to me, take my pet, or it may be included in the will, and there may be a little bit of cash that goes with that that's distributed to the person. But the more elaborate ones and the ones involving more money, and I think Lenora Hemsley, who left all that money in trust for her, was it a dog? For the care of the dog. And that can be done, and I've done a number of those where they're quite extensive. There's very, very comfortable provisions made for the pets for their lives after their owners die. So it's really a fascinating area and one that is pretty much only limited by one's imagination. Now, the other thing that people need to be aware of is the IRS is always there. So if these funds that are set aside for the pet are generating income, the pet does not file an income tax return. The pet does not get a personal exemption. So the trust, if it's in the format of a trust, or the new owner or caretaker of the pet has that invested, they're going to be paying the income tax on it. Not necessarily a big issue, except for larger trusts, but nonetheless, that's there as well because the pets are not taxpayers.
Interesting. Okay, so that takes care of passing pets on. It can be done, people, with a trust. Would that trust be necessarily an expensive trust, or is it fairly straightforward, you think?
Well, it
doesn't sound too difficult.
No, it's not.
Kibbles and bits.
Well, kibbles and bits every day and,
bones.
Butterscotch pudding at night and off you go.
My dog likes the little chicken pieces.
Oh.
What pieces of the chicken?
It looks like breast meat to me.
Parts?
No. It's real sliced chicken. Breast dried up jerky. Yeah, for dogs. Oh. He loves those.
Oh, those. Okay.
Yeah, loves them.
Okay.
So my trust will say he gets
big bags of chicken,
one of those.
Jerky?
He's not long for this world, so I'm going to let him have a good few years if I pass away before him.
I see.
Well, what do you think the chances are?
Slim to none.
that you'll pass away before him?
I hope not.
Okay. Well, we do too.
Thank you. So
your dog doesn't have a very good voice for the radio, so.
Yeah.
Have him in.
Okay, so the next one, Pete.
Well, let's back up for a second, because you asked the cost and how difficult they are, and we kind of joked around about that. But a very straightforward trust is no more expensive than perhaps a trust for the kids, or less so. But then if you get into more elaborate trusts, such as very detailed care instructions and safeguards and overseers to make sure that the who's ever caring for the pet is doing it properly, and of course the trustee for the trust is different from the person taking care of the pet, all those sorts of things, then it can get quite expensive depending on the detail people want to put into it.
Okay.
But being personal property, if you just wanted to hand the pet over to someone else, that could be done via will.
Oh, yes.
Just naming a person who's going to receive, just like they would receive the dining room
chair.
Right,
but the whole idea of the trust, not everybody with a pet needs to do the trust. Mm-hmm. The idea is to make sure the assets are there to take care of the pet, because it's one thing to give it to someone. That person has no obligation to care for it and can say, I can't afford it. I don't have the time. I don't want to. So by holding some money in a trust, and maybe that caregiver is trustee of the trust, there is assets there to take care of said pet.
But typically, if you're going to that, you probably don't want the caregiver to be in charge of the trust.
Right, because then they can take all the money and still screw over the dog.
Sure. And then, the dog has an unfortunate accident, prematurely, and all of a sudden that money is...
Yeah, you don't want to leave your bird to someone, and the last word that bird hears is, pull!
Love dogs, but you somehow hate birds, apparently.
I don't hate birds. I just thought that was pretty funny.
It was a joke at birds' expense.
Okay, so...
So we've covered pets?
I think we've covered pets. That's good. You want to do what? Vacation homes, timeshares?
We'll do vacation homes.
Okay. Vacation homes, one of the issue with a vacation home is that everything's fine when mom and dad are around and they're calling the shots, but then as the home passes down to the kids, you have three families that are in control of the vacation home. Let's just say it's a cabin or a condo up in the mountains. And then how do you decide who has the use, when they have the use, how are expenses split, what happens if there's some deferred maintenance that needs to be addressed, and one of the kids says, well, we haven't been up there in a year. We're just not really interested. So probably the worst thing you can do for your children is to leave it to them in equal shares. And then you're pretty well assured the children are not going to get along with regard to that asset, and maybe not at all. So it's a good idea to talk to the kids before, as you're trying to figure out what to do with this. And maybe there's one child that would really like it and the other two aren't interested, or maybe they're all interested, in which case maybe it goes into a trust or a limited liability company, some other entity. And within that entity, there'll be provisions that mom and dad set up as to who has priority, when, how expenses are shared, and what happens if someone doesn't come up with their share of the expenses, and does that affect their ownership? Does that eliminate their use of it? All those sorts of things come into play. And the point of all of that really is to avoid conflict within the family and to preserve the vacation home for the use of the family, if that is what everybody wants. And you may talk to the kids, and they say, it's been great, but we have no interest in it, or none of us are in state. We can't use it. Let's just sell it and divide up the proceeds. So talk to the kids about that first before you start really making plans for them with regard to any vacation home. But the caution is, probably conventional wisdom, is do not put it in the three names, I'm assuming three kids, put it in the name of the three children without talking to them or having some provision for how that property is managed and how the governance, basically, of the usage of that property. So,
What sounds like so simple and something you'd want to do with your kids can oftentimes turn into something very much unintended. Because I think a lot of those shared inheritable assets do create that kind of conflict in the kids that people don't really think about while they're alive. They're, kids, they all get along now. Well, it's because they aren't forced to deal with each other and make decisions about a common asset.
Right.
once they all have to agree on something.
Well, or even cough up some money to keep it going.
Yeah.
So that when you involve the finances, that's when things get a little more difficult.
Yeah.
So, But that's the conventional wisdom, is to not leave it outright in equal shares. That's just not a good formula for success.
But it's probably what a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm. It is.
That's the thing, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you chat about this. We're not getting into the deep depth. We're trying to give you just a brief overview, very similar to the Money Magazine article. And if people have questions, of course, you offer a complimentary meeting so you can chat with them a little bit about how sure. this would work. But I would say that goes against what most people think they would want to do.
Right, because they're wanting to be fair to the right. kids. So what's more fair than having it be equal and everyone shares
and
in it?
I would say, because I ran into this with a couple I was working with once, and the issue became some kids wanted the place, other kids didn't, and they wanted money instead.
Sure.
They don't want anything to do with the vacation home. They don't want to drive. It was a mountain home.
Yeah.
They don't want to drive up there. They don't want to use it, and they would prefer money being cashed out. And the issue you sometimes run into is when the parents pass away, there's no liquidity or not enough liquidity, and the kids who, liquidity meaning money, to pay off the children who don't want it. And some of the kids are being forced to take out mortgages to pay off the children who do want out so they can keep it in the family. And it was just causing problems.
And sometimes it's just not possible. So what happens? It gets sold over the objection of one or more of the children. And it's a heartbreaker for them because they're really emotionally attached to the property. But the reality is, it's not divisible, and and they can't afford to buy out their siblings.
And that's where I tell people that life insurance can add the liquidity to keep the family together, because there's nothing that pulls a family apart more than the acrimony sometimes that follows the passings of the husband and wife, the father and mother.
Yep, that's true. They're grieving, and then you throw in this conflict in the middle of it.
Exactly.
And through the grief process, they're not thinking clearly sometimes, or they're just overly emotional. Something that would set them off would not have under normal circumstances. So it's a difficult time for the family.
And that's where life insurance can offer the liquidity to the estate to pay off those who want out, allow those who want in to stay in, and keeps the family together more, I think.
And Jim, let me jump in on that, because life insurance is, as you've indicated, is a good solution to problems when you're trying to equalize. And it doesn't have to be a vacation home.
Right,
it can
estate be, equalization.
It could be a business. It could be any number of things. And life insurance fits very well into that. And you have good leverage because you're paying the premiums. It's not a dollar-for-dollar transaction very often. And if the parents are insurable, it is a very easy solution to being able to provide equality without having to divide everything, single item, on an equal basis.
Exactly. We call it in our office estate equalization.
Yep.
And we'll have to refer those people to professionals such as you. But oftentimes I'm the first responder, so to speak, in the sense I'm chatting with the person, and they're sharing with us either during the initial coffee and a second opinion or during our follow-up meetings, and I point out to them that you can accomplish estate equalization, especially in the case of a business. I have a few clients who are in that situation, and there'd be one child who wants the business, the other doesn't, and the last thing you want to do is be breaking up a business just to placate one child over another. Life insurance can solve a lot of that. So anyways, that's what we wanted to chat about. How about Chris's favorite topic? Because he just loves these. He loves timeshares. You have like four, don't you, Chris? You just love them.
Negative. I am not an owner of timeshares, in full disclosure.
We've warned people before.
I will say
about...
I have been in my life a timeshare owner.
Okay.
I was one of the lucky ones, though, who got out.
Right, because a timeshare is that gift that keeps on giving.
Or taking.
Yeah.
So why don't you point out the negatives of timeshare? Because everybody thinks, oh, I'm going to go get that free TV. And what's the problem with all that?
We'll have to give probably a teaser.
Oh, teaser.
And then we'll finish this
with
up
the time
after the
remaining.
Break.
Yeah. Well, the problem is, it's as we were chatting earlier, and may have mentioned, it's like a tar baby, if you remember Uncle Remus and Briar Rabbit.
I have no idea what you are talking
really?
About.
Walt really? Disney? Really?
Uncle Remus and Briar Rabbit?
Sure.
Hmm.
Would the rabbit get tar stuck to him or something, like a tarred and feathered?
well, they made tar babies. And when you touch them, imagine letting go of something that has tar all over it. It sticks to you.
Yeah, and you can't get away from it.
You're not visualizing this?
I have no idea what you're talking about. So the rabbit, I know what a rabbit is. So what, it
he
fell
was just
into
a character in the story.
Yeah.
He was a character in the story.
So like they did in the Old West where they tied and feathered you.
No.
No feathers.
No.
And for a different purpose.
Yeah. And they didn't put tar on the person. They set up a tar baby, and then this person
What's this tar baby thing?
It's like a little
stick figure kind
of
thing.
Yeah, a little, it's tar, made out of tar, and they punch it or hit it or something, and then they stick, and then they put their hand on it to pull their other hand away, and then their foot.
The more they touch it, it'll stick on there.
What the hell's this got to do with a
rabbit? Oh, my gosh. We'll clarify all this
with
Jim during the break.
What's the hint? Because I have no idea what you're talking about.
So we'll get to timeshares when we get back from this short break. When we come back, we will be hearing the number one song from 40 years ago this week, which would be 1975. This song was one of the most popular crossover hits, making it big on both the country and pop charts. It also became the signature song for this composer, singer, and sometimes actor. That's a very detailed hint.
Rhinestone Cowboy.
We're doing a lot better job with the hints. Your vote is Rhinestone Cowboy?
Don't you want to hear it?
Well, I'm going to hear it first, but okay, I'm just taking a guess.
That's fine. We'll log your guess, and then we'll find out when we come back from this break. So this is the Retirement and IRA Show. Thanks for joining us today. We have a very short break. We'll be back with you with our discussion on the trickiness of passing on a timeshare right after this.
And tar babies.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. This is, in fact, the number one song in 1975 this week.
I nailed it.
Yeah. And Jim,
looking very proud of himself,
uncharacteristically nailed it.
Yeah.
Wow. It is, in fact, Glenn Campbell, Rhinestone Cowboy. There's not too many crossover hits in 1975. There was this and one other artist.
It was?
Like a rhinestone cowboy.
See? You're right. Olivia Newton-John.
Yeah, your girlfriend.
Kind of a crossover. She did country first.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I nailed
Big
that one.
Big in 1975.
Yes. Glenn Campbell, Rhinestone Cowboy.
The other one might, I don't know if...
Lineman of the
when
County,
is,
I like
when
that
When does Linda Ronstadt...
She was a country singer?
She did country before she did pop, and then she went on and did like big band vocals with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. So she's multi-talented as well.
Okay.
I like Linda Ronstadt.
Yeah.
Well, that was the number one song in America 40 years ago.
1975.
40 years ago this week.
And why do we listen to these crazy songs, Jim?
We do this as we lead into what's new on help with MySocialSecurity.com. Normally, or previously, we used to always look at the number 3, 2, and 1 song 40 years ago. Because when Social Security first started many, many, many moons ago, 80 years ago, nobody, Pete, had paid into Social Security yet, except maybe you. And... because they hadn't paid into it, there was no benefit. So they had a convoluted calculation based on 40 elapsed years. And we thought we would...
Bless you.
If we say something, if we say it ahead of time,
I almost
we scared it
on
off.
Air. Wow.
I was about to have to push the sneeze button.
We don't have one because
we don't have
a cough button, so I wasn't going to sneeze. Whew. Okay. Yeah. You just touched that area right between your tongue and nose.
Really? Between your tongue and your nose?
right here.
I don't want you to stick my fingers in my mouth.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, that'd be my mouth.
Yeah. That'd be the roof of my mouth.
You touch, right?
You mean between your lip and your...
Your lip and nose.
Nose, okay.
You touch right there and it keeps you from sneezing. Mm-hmm.
If you touch your tongue to your nose, that also will stop it.
Yeah, right.
You can't do that?
No.
No, I can't either. I know people who can't.
Anyways, why do we do this? So we look back.
If you can touch your tongue to your elbow, You probably have a broken shoulder. Try it. You can't lick your own elbow.
You can't lick your own elbow. Okay.
Yeah. We need to get a little camera in here.
Yeah, something. Yeah. Because Jim tries all these things.
Yeah, you'll do anything.
Anyway, so.
Oh, really?
What we do, we used to look back 40 years in honor of Social Security's first calculation, which involved 40 elapsed years.
And mainly since Jim likes.
And my insistence of. Keeping in the 1970s because I like 70s music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that caused a little bit of confusion with some iTunes listeners who couldn't quite understand. They misunderstood the 40 years with the 35 elapsed years and
computational years. It's even confusing,
years.
Jim.
And they were getting confused. Mm-hmm. And we also have one listener, a very nice listener in New Jersey, who pretty much leveled with us. One day I was talking to him on the phone, Pete, and he's like, I hate 70s music. Will you guys get into the 1980s? So because of all those reasons, and because it is the 80th anniversary of Social Security, we now look back 80 years, 40 years, and 35 years as we lead into what's new on Help With My Social Security, which, of course, is a blog Chris and I have been doing that teaches people the tips, tricks, and strategies of Social Security planning. See, now he just sneezed.
I will say we've been doing the blog now long enough that it's becoming difficult to come up with topics. So what we really love is when people send us questions.
They do. Although we've been doing pretty well lately, getting some topics.
Yeah,
but we got a very nice kudos. Did you ever get back to that person?
I have to know who you're talking about.
Someone from
New York. Not right now.
Well, I'm looking. Somebody from New York sent us an email, really liked our website, helpmysocialsecurity.com. Did you get that from Julia?
I don't recall. I'll go back and review.
Well, I got to find it to make sure you get it.
Why don't you find it while
then she's not going to like
while
us
Pete
anymore.
And I talk about timeshares
and tar babies
and tar babies
and Song of the South,
which may or may not still be available to view.
Yes, you were talking about that.
There was some.
That's a shame.
There was some hubbub about
yes,
that.
I can understand. It wasn't entirely politically correct, but it was. They had some great music in it and good story. Yeah. So. Anyway.
So the timeshare was being compared to a tar baby.
Yes, it was.
Did you,
tar
did
is
you
very
get this
sticky.
Email right there?
Hey, we're on another topic over here.
Jim's holding up. For those of you in Radio Land.
Yes, and that's actually the topic of this week's blog post. So
oh, okay.
One way or another, she's
did
getting...
Did you reach out to this woman?
I don't recall. I'll look up. I'll
okay.
Look.
Well, for those who don't know, we got a very nice email from someone who we call George from, I think, New York. For some reason, I thought New York. Why did I
probably
think
probably because of the accent in which she wrote it in.
Probably.
No, somewhere on here. I don't know how it came in as New York. But maybe it's not New York.
Well,
but if so,
it
is
New
York,
I
was going to say, yeah, if it is New York, we can put a star on New York. But this person gave us a nice little shout-out on our help with socialsecurity.com. She said she found it very beneficial. She's going to tell all her friends about it.
Oh, very nice.
Wonderful.
But you answer her question.
I do.
And just reach out to her in an email, though, and let her know.
I will.
Okay.
If I haven't
so
already.
Do we want to talk about that blog then, now?
No, that's in the fourth segment.
I see.
We're jumping a little bit ahead.
Way ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We could, though. Would you like to discuss it now, Jim?
Discuss what?
What's new on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com?
Have we led up to it already?
Well, you kind of have. It is the third segment.
Yeah.
Is it the third segment?
Right now it is.
We do it in the fourth segment.
Correct. But we kind of, you've kind of been not
well,
letting
no, let
go.
Let Pete talk about rental homes or whatever
I would
he's
really
about.
Love that, actually. So timeshares and tar babies. So what's the issue with leaving a timeshare to anyone?
Well, you're potentially leaving them a liability, which, of course, they can say no thanks to. It's called a disclaimer and probably well advised to do so. But timeshares generally, depending on the terms of the timeshare, may not end at your death. And as a consequence, then there may be a claim for the ongoing expenses of that timeshare, the maintenance fees and other fees that are charged that may be a liability that will potentially come out of your estate prior to it going to the children because it is a liability. And very often the kids don't want it and probably shouldn't take it because of that ongoing expense. And so it becomes an issue at death and would advise everybody, even if they're very happy with their timeshare, and I have clients who are. But what happens to it at death is an ongoing liability of the estate, and do they really want their assets to be going to the timeshare?
Now, the liability to timeshare doesn't die when you die.
Not necessarily.
It might go back to the developer or the timeshare company itself at death, you have to read the timeshare agreement to understand
right.
what happens to yours.
And there's different kinds. There's a contractual timeshare where you get usage of it. There's interval ownership where you own this unit for a period of time each year. So it's carved out for you. And so, you know, there's one's you own real estate. The other is you have a contractual right. And so it's going to depend on the form that it takes as to what you have. It may, in fact, be real estate. So there's not an issue of the timeshare company taking it back automatically. It's got to be transferred through a probate process, unfortunately. So it's good to know what you have first. But timeshares may not be something you want to pass on, and it may be something that as a beneficiary you will and don't want
and
to
if
receive.
If you haven't bought a timeshare and or if you've bought one and maybe haven't owned it long enough to realize some of the pitfalls, what we're talking about here is the tremendous sometimes liabilities, not just the maintenance fees, but a lot of timeshares don't do proper, regular, substantial maintenance, and you can then suddenly, maybe you're perfectly happy with the timeshare for the first 15 years, and then it needs new roofs, and the outside needs to be done, and there's plumbing issues, and all these things can happen. And a lot of the timeshare agreements are written that whatever the expense is, they're going to send you a bill for your portion of it, so you can, out of the blue, get a very substantial bill. I know someone who had a timeshare in Mexico that was hit by a hurricane. Well, guess what? There's a little bit of damage, usually, that goes along with hurricanes, and they received very large bills for their portion of the repairs that were not covered by insurance and things like that. So,
wow. So
there's this exposure that you have there with these timeshares that you may not anticipate. I'm not going to list any specifically. There are certainly, I will admit, some pretty good timeshare agreements and timeshares where they are maintained meticulously,
yeah,
and they are very transparent with their financial agreements, and everybody knows what's going on, and it's at a very attractive place that people always want to go, so there's always demand for it. And but I would, from my experience, there's far more of the bad ones than the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
I think the really good ones are few and far between, but can be found.
Well, so what do you recommend for passing them on? Mm-hmm. Or what if you have one and you just want it to go away?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. There are folks who are advertising on the radio who claim that
I mean at death, not you're willing to keep it, but you don't want to pass it on to your kids. You don't want to hit them with the liability and the cost and the risks. Can you just not do anything, not leave it to anyone, and when the estate settles, that's it? Or if you did want to pass it on to someone, is it passed on just through the will or through a beneficiary deed, or how would it be passed on?
It's going to depend on what the contractual arrangement and how you have it. If you actually own real estate, a portion of the real estate, that's going to differ from a contractual, right to use the property. So reading that agreement and determining that, a lot of them will have some provision in there. If it's silent, then it's just there. And so if you're wanting to get out, you don't want to pass it on, and assuming that it's not forfeited at death or there's a provision for a buyback or something like that, then you're going to be you're either going to force it in the probate or leave it, if use a revocable trust, avoid probate, causing the timeshare company to have to open a probate estate to pursue it themselves. All of that are hurdles and expenses that they may not want to incur, and they walk away. That's your best hope at that point, is that they just walk away if there's no provision contractually within the timeshare ownership agreement that allows you to walk away.
Now, when you walk away, does that share go back to the company and they can sell it to someone else?
It's just going to depend on what they have in terms of their agreements as to what happens if you stop paying. There's a liability there, of course, but there may be a time at which they can foreclose for back fees and maintenance and costs and that sort of thing. You just have to go back to read the agreement to see if there's any.
I think that's where people get in real trouble, is they end up with a timeshare that there is no resale market for it. So the timeshare people don't want it back, so they don't pursue taking it back. They just let the fees continue to accrue, and you have this giant liability out there, which ultimately they probably hope that they can find a way to come after you, or they're going to be able to pursue the estate for these monies or something like that, because the timeshare, even though you haven't paid in 4 years, they don't pursue taking it back because they know they can't resell it. Those are the worst possible positions, I think, to be in with these, and a lot of people have found themselves in this position. So that you certainly don't want to hand that time bomb over to your kids. So having some sort of strategy in place where that doesn't get given to them, or if it's headed towards them, they're aware that they can turn it down.
Yes.
Because you can't be forced to take something in an inheritance, correct?
That's right.
You can't. There's nothing that can be forced upon you. So the children need to be well aware that if it's headed towards them, that they have the right to say no.
Yes. No, and the legal term for it is disclaimer.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. Okay, and what's the last item you got there in your list, Pete?
Airline miles.
Airline miles.
And we can dispose of that pretty quickly. Oh. And you just need to contact the carrier to determine what provision they have for transfer. Delta and American Airlines, which are the two mentioned in the article, don't allow those to be transferred at death, although they do mention that American Airlines does on occasion. It's a case-by-case basis. And I don't know about the other major carriers, but you just have to contact the carrier to find out if you, in fact, can transfer those miles.
And that's probably an asset most people don't even think about passing on. I have a lot of points on my Amazon credit card, and because I charge everything but pay the credit card off monthly.
Sure.
So I have probably $800 on there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an asset that I don't even think about. What would happen if I passed away to that? It all depends what Amazon's rules are?
Yes,
well,
it
does.
I would immediately order something to be delivered to the office here.
Well, does Amazon sell caskets? We could probably take care of that as your dying bequest or wish.
They may. I've never never searched for one, but now...
You might want to get one and just kind of park it in the garage until...
Here I am trying to be serious, and you guys are making light of a situation.
You're worried about your Amazon points when you pass?
I'm just making a point. There's people with more points than I have points, but it's an asset I never thought of. Yeah, mine's only $800, but I bet there's people out there with a couple of $1,000. What happens to points like that? That's an interesting...
You're making a good point, Jim.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Excellent. We don't know.
We don't know.
We'd have to read the agreement with Amazon.
Per credit card, they all have different...
Well,
or airline or store, they all have different rules.
Sure,
is what you're saying.
Yeah, the incentives, the points that a lot of credit cards are providing, as well as airlines and other folks, in the terms of service or agreement, they're going to have the provisions as to whether or not it's transferable.
Okay.
Somebody could have a boatload of them, though, especially if they traveled for work or something, and amassed huge quantities of points and then passed before being able to use them. That would be a shame if those all just went to waste. But they may very well. You mentioned who were the airlines?
American and Delta. Now, United Airlines, I know in planning, it's been maybe 10, 15 years ago, someone did have a lot of points accumulated. At that time, United allowed those to be passed on, and we had those provisions in their will as to who they wanted to receive those. Now, I don't know if that's true anymore, but that was at the time.
Interesting. Yes. Okay. Well, that's why we wanted to cover that little subtopic on today's show.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty good.
Yeah.
How much time do we have?
Real life things that people run into. We have 9 minutes in this segment.
Nine? Wow, we got more time.
Sure.
All right.
Are we out of topics? Is that what you're saying?
No, we are not out of topics.
Oh, okay. I didn't think so.
Kind of threw me for a loop. Do you want to do the guy who got nailed by the IRS for...
Well, those are always good stories.
Yes.
What can you do it in 9 minutes, though?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, come on. I'm pithy.
Go ahead.
But lengthy.
Yeah, pithy but lengthy, right.
I thought this was interesting because we're hit with this all the time in working with IRAs, people trying to come up with creative ways.
Well, before you move on, whenever you say that, I want to remind people that the IRAs have now been around long enough. They've probably seen whatever creative thing you're trying to do and have put in place rules to prevent it. So if you think you've come up with some glorious new idea, I would be very, very careful, as this person's about to find out.
What had happened, and the guy lost in tax court, not for the reason, Pete, that I thought, and I don't know if you've heard of this tax court case. It just recently came out. Not for the reason I thought he would lose.
Well, why did you think he would lose?
Well, let's get to the facts of the case.
All right. And then you can give us your opinion. Mm-hmm. And then
your
legal
opinion. We'll shoot it at four holes.
My legal opinion is worthless.
I'm not the legal
person. All right, so the gentleman's name was Ellis. We'll just leave it at Ellis. This being a tax court case, everything is public record. Mm-hmm. But we don't need to mention the companies he used to work for. But what he did do is he was working for a company and he quit, and he had a very, very large 401k, $319,000 401k. Mm-hmm. Okay. What he did is he wanted to take that $319,000 and use it to fund a business.
Oh.
Okay.
Sure.
So far?
His own business?
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the operating agreement of his business called CST, and it was going to sell used cars. The operating agreement called for Ellis to open an IRA that would own 98% of CST in exchange for $319,000. Just happened to equal what was in his 401k. Mm-hmm.
Coincident.
Purely. The other 2% of CST would be owned by an unrelated party to Ellis. Mm-hmm. Because an LLC has no stock, the IRA would own CST by purchasing member certificates. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay? After CST was formed, Ellis established the IRA. So he formed CST first. He established an IRA. I won't mention the trust company. And in June of 2005, he took his 401k and rolled it over into his IRA and bought the Ellis membership certificates. Mm-hmm. Okay? The CST, rather, membership certificates. Okay. After the purchase, one remaining membership certificate showing the 98% ownership was issued to his IRA. And there was just under $2,000 remaining in the IRA. The rest was just one certificate. Mm-hmm. So he essentially transferred $319,000 from a 401k to an IRA, which then went right back to a company he started to sell used cars to fund the new car business. Mm-hmm. Okay, that, Pete, is where I thought he was going to run into trouble. It was there. It's not what the court said. So, in late 2005, they created another LLC called CDJ. I hate these acronyms. Which Mr. Ellis owned 50% of. His wife owned 12.5%. And his three children owned the other 12.5%. CDJ had one purpose. It was to buy commercial investment properties and to release them. So this new company, which was financed through a mortgage, purchased a property and leased it to his first company. You can see how muddy it's getting here. Okay.
Leased it to the car business.
Leased it to the car business.
Got it.
Which was opened essentially with $319,000 funneled from his 401k to his IRA.
Right.
Then he creates another company that is bought property through a mortgage. Mm-hmm. They didn't say how he got the mortgage, and then leased it back to this company, okay? In late November, in order to come up with a December 31st value of his IRA, the trust company holding that one certificate requested a fair market value estimate of that one certificate's value, and they reported that value to the IRS as $321,000. So a little bit of a profit. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, here's where it gets tricky.
It's not tricky up till now.
I thought the guy already blew it up.
Right.
Tax court ruled so far what he did was okay. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea why they said that. But then Ellis paid himself $9,754 in 2005 as his role of general manager. These payments were made from CST's corporate checking account, not from his IRA. CST deducted the amount on its corporate tax return as compensation and reported it as W-2. Ellis and his wife filed a joint tax return and included the $9,754 received from CST. Remember, CST is the company that he took $319,000 from his 401k on, funneled it to an IRA. The IRA essentially funneled it right back to him, and he put in one certificate of ownership into the IRA.
Got it.
Okay. In 2006, Ellis was paid $29,000 in compensation from CST, which again was reported as W-2. Is this the end of the show?
No.
Oh, the end of the segment. Okay.
2 minutes.
You keep showing up the 2 minutes. Okay. 5 years later, the IRS audits him. 5 years later, 2011 now. The IRS issued a notice for a deficiency in 2005 and 6 for underpayment of income tax. They claimed that all of this was a prohibited transaction. And the IRS argued that in some point, they did not specify when, that they said in some point between 2005 and 2006, Ellis had engaged in a prohibited transaction with his IRA, and thus the entire IRA was deemed to be distributed to him the first day of the year, as we all know. We talked about this on previous shows. The IRS assessed a 10% early distribution penalty because he was under 59 and a half, and also a 20% inaccuracy penalty for... underpayments of income tax. Ellis took his case to court. He said he did not partake in a prohibited transaction. He loses in court, but not for the reason you think. And when we get back, we'll explain what the tax court said and why he lost.
Interesting. So when we come back from this break, we will hear the number one song from 35 years ago this week, which would be 1980. Next up, the number one song is a disco hit. This is what you love, Jim. Made famous by a supreme pop talent. That's the hint.
The Supremes.
Nope. Wrong. You're all cocky now that you got
one. Pop talent. That would be Michael Jackson.
Okay, no. But we'll find out when we come back.
You just look like one of
the
Supremes.
This is the Retirement IRA Show. We'll also get the update on what's new with helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to the final segment of the Retirement and IRA Show here for September 5th, 2015. That is the number one hit from 35 years ago this week. That would be 1980. Is that why you didn't want to be into the 80s? That's a good song, though. I like that song.
I don't really like that song.
You don't?
No.
I still don't think it was Michael Jackson, Jim, regardless of what you say.
That's not Michael Jackson.
Can I guess the song? Because I have no idea who the singer is.
Okay, what's
singer's
the song?
Singer's some woman.
Really? Okay.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say the song is Upside Down.
It is.
Ha! All right, Pete, your turn. Who sung it?
Well, I think the only Supreme that really made her way was Diana Ross.
That'd exactly. Be my
guess. Oh, that was nailed the hint. It. Get it, Supreme.
Yeah, Supreme pop star.
Gotcha.
That was Upside Down by Diana Ross, number one song 35 years ago this week.
It is very disco-y for the 1980s. I thought disco was dead by then.
No, this actually, I think it actually came out in 79, didn't hit the charts, because I could have sworn I had it on a 1979 compilation CD that I own.
I don't think they had CDs in 79.
No, but they made it afterwards.
Oh, a 1979 compilation CD you bought later.
The best of 79.
Gotcha. Best of,
the best of 79.
I could have sworn that was on there, but I might be thinking of something else.
Okay.
Well, it may take a while to get to number one if it came out.
Well, this was September, so I can't imagine it would have taken that long. But anyway, it was, in fact, assuming Tina's right, who gathers this research information for us.
She's your research lead.
We hire professionals here.
Yes, you do.
So, so I wonder, what is new with helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, Jim?
I have no idea.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
It's going to be that email question.
Well, let me tell you.
Right?
It is that email question from the person supposedly from New York.
It is from New York because they said they're from Manhattan, and Manhattan's in New
York.
Well,
there you go.
What about Manhattan,
Kansas? So based
on...
Huh?
Manhattan,
oh,
Kansas.
Oh, it could be.
No, she said I'm in my...
Manhattan?
Manhattan, Kansas.
We're not in Manhattan, Kansas.
Well, are you sure? The email would have come to us the same, whether it was from Kansas or New York.
No, if you're from Manhattan, Kansas, you would say, I'm writing to you from Kansas. She said, I'm writing to you from Manhattan.
Okay, well, we'll have to see.
See, all our listeners in Manhattan, Kansas will email in.
All one?
Oh, come on.
Where's our star? I want a star in New York.
I'll have to dig it up. But how about if I tell you what's new with helpwithmysocialsecurity.com?
It's going to be that woman's question.
It is. What was her question, Jim?
Her question was, if she took a lump sum Social Security benefit payout, how would she be taxed?
Exactly. So normally, Social Security benefits come in the form of monthly deposits into your account. Used to be checks. Now they're electronically deposited. But sometimes, for a variety of reasons, you'll receive a lump sum of several months, maybe even years' worth of benefits all at one time. And her question was, what is going to happen with the taxes there? So I discuss on the blog post, but he's just, he can't sit down and handle.
Oh, he wants to get that star up there.
But anyway, I discuss the ramifications of such a situation. And believe it or not, the IRS has instituted a procedure to mitigate the tax problem. And that problem might be you receive such a large lump sum payment that it pushes that year's income into an income tax bracket you'd prefer not to be in.
That would be
translated anything, too much taxes.
I was going to say the bracket that I would prefer to be not prefer to be in is anything over zero.
Right, exactly. So they actually have a mechanism, a publication, and a worksheet that looks back to prior years when those benefits should have been paid to you and allows you to make a tax adjustment in the current year, and it then prevents you from having to file amended returns from those prior years, which would have at first appear to be the only way really to remedy this. They don't force you to do that, luckily.
So that harkens back to the old income averaging availability of years past, when if you had a huge influx of income, you could choose to average, which is, by the way, no longer available.
No, but it is in this case.
Yes, it is.
So they effectively handle it in that way, and I describe how that is done.
Wow.
Any questions, Jim?
No.
What's new, pussycat?
Okay.
So back to the court case.
Mr. Ellis.
Let's get back to Mr. Ellis.
I want to make sure
Ellis.
We get to this, because I'm on pins and needles here.
I'm sure you are. Mm-hmm. So again, what we have people here is somebody skirting. Whenever, and Pete, feel free to opine, but whenever somebody comes to me and is trying to come up with a creative way to get money from a retirement account, which the IRS and Congress is pretty explicit on the prohibited transaction rules.
Right.
Prohibited transaction rules simply say, if you are going to benefit at all, you are a disqualified person, which Chris is pretty much everyone but...
Siblings.
Siblings, which is odd.
They list all these people in your family. Parents.
Grandparents.
Kids.
Spouse.
Grandparents. But siblings
are
not
excluded
in the list for some strange
but
reason.
But as Ed Slott says, Pete... don't bank on it.
I don't want to be the first one to test the fact right. that my brother wasn't listed.
But what the IRS and Congress don't want is people self-dealing with their 401ks and IRAs, Pete. So you really can't benefit from an investment. You can't go out and buy a house and live in it with your IRA. We've talked about this. Mm-hmm. So this man...
Your IRA can benefit. Because that's the point of investing with your IRA,
right.
is so your IRA can benefit, and then you ultimately can reap the benefits under the distribution rules that apply to IRAs.
Now, they have ruled you can work for a publicly traded company. Let's just pick one, say, I got an empty Starbucks coffee cup in front of me. Mm-hmm. So you could work for Starbucks and buy Starbucks stock with your IRA, and that is not a prohibited transaction.
Nope, that's allowed.
But if you are going to start your own coffee business, or in Ellis's case, your own car selling business, and somehow think you are going to be able to use money in your 401k or money in your IRA to help start that company, the IRS is coming after you. And they're going to say that is a prohibited transaction. It's self-dealing. And Chris, what happens when a prohibited transaction gets blown up?
The entire IRA is disqualified, and it's considered a complete distribution.
And it's considered a complete distribution in the year you did it. He did this in 2005. Mm-hmm. He wasn't hauled into the IRS until 2011.
So they backdate the penalty.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So as I read this court case, the summary from the Ed Slott Group, I thought, this guy's toast. Yeah, I mean,
you thought
it just
when he put in the
$300,000
right. Yeah. Is the violation. It isn't, actually. If he wasn't working at that, this is me opining now. If he wasn't working at the business or benefiting from the business, he was just taking his money and investing in a business opportunity, that is allowed.
Absolutely.
So that part, the first step he made, didn't blow it up. Correct?
The first step, but not for the reason you quoted.
I'm thinking that leasing to his company that was owned by the IRA is where he ran afoul of the self-dealing.
Okay.
As soon as that auto company started paying him, definitely there's an issue there.
Okay. Well, you said one thing. You said two things. You said one thing. Mm-hmm.
Chris, can I say two things too?
All right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
When he started paying himself, that was.
Yes. Let's get into what happened. Mm-hmm. So the IRS, he fights IRS. He says, look, because IRS said your entire IRA is considered a prohibited mm-hmm. transaction as of 1st January 2005. You owe a 10% mm-hmm. penalty on the $320,000. It was $321,000 that actually went over. Remember, he invested $319,000, left $2,000 in the IRA. IRS said you owe a 10% penalty on the $319,000. You owe taxes on the $319,000. You owe a 20% underpayment accuracy penalty. Yeah. And you owe penalties because it's now 2011 and you did this in 2005. I mean, this guy was being nailed.
As they're wont to do.
Mm-hmm. And he went to tax court. The tax court, the IRS argued that the transfer from the IRA to CST was a prohibited transaction.
I don't think it was.
Tax court agreed. Okay. But the tax court stuck to a 1996 case. So here's what happened. The court had to decide if Ellis engaged in a prohibited transaction. The IRS first argued that a prohibited transaction occurred in 2005 when his IRA acquired CST. Remember, he owned CST. He owned 98% of it. Was essentially his IRA. 2% was someone else.
Be careful. Don't say he owned it. He didn't own it. His IRA owned it.
He technically didn't own it. His IRA.
It's just like owning a goat farm. You're allowed to own a goat farm in its entirety in your IRA. You're not allowed to work there or work on it or benefit from it directly while it's held in your IRA. But
he was.
This is his goat farm.
He was. So, Ellis argued it wasn't a prohibited transaction. And he quoted a 1996 case to the tax court in which the tax court back in 96 ruled issuing stock in a newly formed corporation to an IRA is not a prohibited transaction. So that is how he skirted the first argument. Mm-hmm. So the tax court agreed with Ellis.
And Chris.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Excellent.
Were you there?
Just want to make sure we're all on board here.
Credit where credit is due.
Then the IRS came at him and argued the salary from CST was a prohibited transaction. Since Ellis is a fiduciary of his IRA and owned more than 50% of CST, the IRS argued that CST was disqualified after his IRA invested in it and therefore could not pay Ellis a salary. Ellis countered, no, IRS is wrong. It was not a prohibited transaction because the salary he received never came from IRA assets, but came from income directly earned by CST.
I don't feel comfortable with this one. I don't like this one. I don't. I like the IRS. There, I'm uncomfortable with this because it'd be like the goat farm. You harvesting the milk from the goat farm, even though technically your IRA owns it, you are personally receiving benefit from it. And I think that runs afoul of the rule.
What do you think, Pete?
I might be wrong. They might consider it, since it was work done, if you truly did work there, being paid, so it's not like just getting free milk. So maybe that's how he skirted under the rule, but what do you think, Pete?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I'm not, but I think that, and I was tipped off a little bit by Jim saying it's not for the reason you think, and that's why I went to the leasing. It was the issue that got him. But I don't know.
What happened is it was the salary. The tax court stated, and I quote, "To say that CST was merely a company in which Mr. Ellis's IRA invested is a complete mischaracterization. In reality, CST and Mr. Ellis's IRA are substantially one and the same entity. In causing CST to pay him compensation, Mr. Ellis is engaging in the transfer of plan income or IRA assets for his own benefit."
Yeah, if he had paid that $20,000, if CST had paid it into as a benefit of the IRA, went back into his IRA, he would have been fine. Now he couldn't be working there
as a dividend or something. You mean
no? Like if let's say CST is a standalone car dealership, made money. Those benefits flow 98% to 2%, however the split is, with the other entity, to his IRA. That's totally fine. He can't be working there, just like you can't work on the goat farm. And people might be wondering why I'm bringing that up. Longtime listeners know we've discussed owning a goat farm in your IRA before and the issues. He can't work there, period, because that it helps generate income for the car dealership, which then flows into his IRA. So he's helping. It's kind of like buying a fix and flip with your IRA and thinking you can go in there and fix it up, thus enhancing the value of your IRA. Absolutely not. Absolutely prohibited that kind of behavior, and that would be similar
here. I think what I want people to understand with this, it isn't just to pick on Ellis, it's for people to learn, because they always are trying, Pete, creative ways to fund a business or get money out of a retirement account without paying taxes on it. The guy wanted to start a business. He could have took all the money out as a distribution from his IRA, and he didn't want to. So he came up with this creative way of, I'm going to create one company that the IRA invests in, and the company doesn't exist before the IRA, so I can get around that rule. And I'm going to do this, and I'm going to create this LLC that's going to lease money back to you. When you start getting to all that, the IRS is going to look for this and nail it. They're going to try to set an example of you.
Mm-hmm. And the worst part is they don't nail you right away. It's always delayed, which accrues, amasses all these delayed penalties.
Well, the ending of the summary. As a result of the 2005 prohibited transaction, Ellis's entire IRA was disqualified. The entire $321,000 rollover was deemed a taxable distribution. Ellis was under the age of 59 and a half, so the distribution was subject to a 10% early distribution penalty in addition to income taxes, late payment penalties, and a 20% penalty for underpayment. Mm-hmm.
And that $300,000, if you think you're going to take a distribution of $300,000 in 1 year and not have it push you into another tax bracket, it's, you know, so that $300,000 was taxed at a very high rate
in 2005.
In 2005.
Yeah. This guy was nailed in taxes. Oh, I mean, sure. His taxes and penalties had to have eaten well over half of that.
Had to be.
So, anyways, I thought it would be the actual purchasing of a company that he was clearly working for, that he was in a roundabout way benefiting from because he was trying to lease property back to this company. And it all came down to a $9,775 salary. $9,700.
Well, there's the proof he was working there, right? If he had never done that, then it would have to be, someone would have to tip off the IRS that, hey, this guy's working there.
I like your argument, though, Chris. If that $9,075 went to the IRA as profits from the business, and then he took it out as a distribution, he'd still have to pay income taxes on it. So the point would be moot. instead of being salary, it's still being taxed to him. I wonder if that would have passed muster in the eyes of the
not if
tax
he was
club.
Working there. He can't work there.
But they never the issue of him working there never came up. I agree with you. It should have. What do you think, Pete? Because you can't buy a rental property and change a light bulb in that rental property, or it blows up that IRA's rental property.
I don't understand what you're saying. The fact he was working there, and that I thought was the issue.
And the salary is what flagged the fact that he was working there.
Well, the salary is how they discovered it because it's reported.
Exactly.
Okay, so
if he'd worked there voluntarily,
even if it went to the IRA, then as you said, it still wouldn't.
And that's
worked.
Why I said very clearly that if the car dealership made profit and it went to the IRA, as long as he wasn't working there, and you keep insisting he was, that's why I'm saying. If he didn't work there, but the car dealership made money because there were employees there that, you know, caused the business to be profitable, and those profits flowed into the IRA, totally legit, totally fine. He can't go to the dealership and change a light bulb, though. He can't go work there in any way. You could construct
right.
a relationship.
There's nothing against
with this
an
business.
IRA owning an auto dealership.
Absolutely.
Just can't be an auto dealership you own or
no,
remotely
that you
own.
Work
roundabout.
That you work for.
That you work
even without
for.
Compensation,
right?
So,
because the other 2% wasn't owned by him,
no,
isn't that what you said?
Somebody else,
some other person, some other unrelated party.
But they have ruled publicly traded stock.
Yeah, well, that makes
you could
sense.
Work for those companies
because you own such a small percentage. If you own more than half of Starbucks, you wouldn't be able to do it.
True.
But what's interesting, or I guess really what's sad here is that if he invested his $319,000 in the business, now he's hit with these penalties and taxes. I'll guarantee he doesn't have that kind of cash sitting around. It's invested in the business. And for him to dissolve that business, have a fire sale to try to get the money out, he's probably lost the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
I mean, that's the tragedy
here. Yeah, the ramifications were tremendous here.
Yeah.
All to avoid, effectively, a 10% penalty for taking it out early because he had the right to do that. And who knows, maybe did it just divulge his age?
He was under the age of 59 and a half.
Yeah, but if he'd gotten to 55, he might have been able to take the money from the 401k penalty free.
I think he was looking to avoid having to pay any taxes
right.
on the money.
But if he'd at least done that, he would have saved a big chunk of it and maybe started a smaller car dealership.
I think what this highlights, people, if it doesn't pass the smell test, it's going to get flagged. And it's very, very difficult to invest in these non-traditional assets inside an IRA. If it can remotely benefit you, if you or your spouse or your children or your grandparents or your parents or the fiduciary of your IRA, any of those are disqualified persons. If they're going to benefit...
Well, I think the moral of the story is don't get too cute or too clever because it's going to blow up in your face.
And the reason why most of these deals are attractive is because they will somehow benefit you or one of your family members in some inappropriate way, and that's why you're thinking of doing it. That's the very reason
and
why they're disqualified.
What he should have done, if he had good counsel, was apply for PLR, private letter ruling, before doing all this. Mm-hmm. And saying, hey, private letter ruling, for those who don't know, is where an individual can present a case to the IRS either before something happened or after and say, in the case of before, essentially, Pete, you're the attorney, so you fill me in if I'm wrong. You know, here's what I'm looking to do. I'm looking to take money from my 401k, put it in an IRA, invest in 98% of this and do that and have this. Would you guys allow it? And it gives the IRS a chance to review it before anything is done, to come back and say, yes, it looks like we would allow that, or no, it's not going to happen. So if he had done a PLR first, yeah, he'd be out 10 grand on the PLR, but it would have saved him a lot in penalties if the IRS came back and said, no, we're not going to allow it. What do you think?
Well, I agree. However, there are many areas of tax law that the IRS has issued a policy statement that they will not rule in those areas. So this may be one of those sort of wheeler dealer type of arrangements where the IRS says, we're not going to rule in advance on it.
Give it a try and then we'll let you know.
Yeah, pay your money and take your chances. Yeah. So it may not have even been available. What I was thinking you were going to say, Jim, was that the way for him to do this, if he wanted this car dealership, was to have the IRA hire a manager that would manage that, be compensated for that, and he kind of keeps his distance, and he apparently was making some money at it. So, but
that would have worked. The problem with that, Pete, is the same reason many people, when they talk to Chris and I about buying real estate in an IRA, and we tell them, first of all, the inability to even get leverage in there because it's a non-recourse loan. We won't bore our listeners with all that means. But even if you could get the property, you can't be the property manager.
Right.
You can't find the renters. You can't bill the renters.
That's
you
right.
can't do the maintenance. When they hear everything they can't do, they look at us and say, but now I won't make money on it.
Right.
And I say, well, that's the rules, and they won't do it now.
Right.
So, yes, to maybe do it correctly, he would have had to have hired all these people to run the business for him, and that would have been the problem. He may not have been able to have done that profitably, and that's why he chose to.
If anybody's considering something like this, why don't we give out contact information so we can maybe have them run it by either of you before we do that?
Okay.
That's a brilliant idea.
Perfect. Well, if you want to call me, you can. We offer what we call a coffee and a second opinion, as we talked about earlier. Just gives you a chance to come in and chat about a situation just as this that we described, or any type of situation about your retirement, your IRAs, Social Security, things of that nature. Best thing to do is go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Click on the Contact Us button, and there's several different ways you can reach us. But once again, it's JimHelps.com.
Perfect. What about you, Pete?
Well, they can reach me through the internet at peterscotthelps.com, similar to Jim's, but it's my name, PeterScottHelps.com. Or on the phone, the conventional way is 970-339-3500, 970-339-3500. And I'm with the law firm of Cohen, Payton, and Payne, and we do not only estate planning and tax law, but business planning, business succession, transactions, those sorts of things. So we'd be happy to, and we give a first and a second opinion with a plain cup of coffee.
Or water, right?
Yeah.
Well, we want to thank everyone and wish everyone another happy Labor Day.
Mm-hmm. Hit this 20,000? This 2015 version of Labor Day.
We've been on a long
at least around,
time.
Yeah. At least where we are here in Colorado
now,
looks to be a
next
nice
week,
weekend.
Or we pre-record it again?
I think we're live, but I'd have to check the calendar. I don't. There will be a show from the Retirement and IRA show played next week on what would be the 12th of September, and I believe we are
live. On the 12th.
So,
yes, so
if you have a burning question you'd like to call in and ask us live, that'll be the show to do it. You can always send us a message at jimhelps.com. We'll get back to you before that if you'd like, but have a nice weekend. Thanks for joining us here on the Retirement and IRA show.
Like what you just heard? Missed some of today's show? Listen again on iTunes or the RetirementandIRAShow.com.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.